The other day, I was driving a friend's car, just running some errands, and I got to thinking about surveillance, which has been on my mind often these days. And needless to say, it didn't take me very long to find one of those, or notice, I guess, one of those flock cameras on the corner of a highway on ramp. One of those small dark oval shaped things that's mounted on a pole with a solar panel attached to it. Easy thing to overlook. And of course, it scanned the license plate as I drove past it and logged the make and the model of the car and the color and the location and the time. And then it added it to a database that can basically reconstruct the car's movements going back months, if need be. That the one this is one small device on one ordinary corner doing this all day long. So then I parked and walked into the store, and I passed a couple of Ring doorbells mounted on front porches along the way. And then, of course, I got picked up by the store's own cameras inside. And I got my groceries and used my loyalty card at the self-checkout, where I could see myself in yet another camera monitor. Then the phone logged the location, right? So on the way back, I got an ad on my phone for something that was related to what I just bought. And the weird part about all of this is that none of it felt particularly weird, actually. But then when I thought about it for a good 10 seconds, I realized that it absolutely should feel weird. Now, try to imagine what this scenario that I just described would sound like to somebody prior to 9/11 2001. Because that was probably the one defining moment where I think everything changed and led us on this path to where we are now, and of course, where we are headed. So I'm Gen X, and the kind of dystopia that that we were warned about back in the day, that it came with things like I guess jack boots and checkpoints and like a face that you'd see on a wanted poster, right? But instead, apparently what we've got is well, it's definitely considerably more convenient and I would say insidious. And it remembered your preferences, and it asked very politely to enable location services. And of course, we just went ahead and checked the accept box. So I think Orwell got it half right. Because in his book, 1984, I guess you could say that the that brand of surveillance was imposed in a more, let's say, physical manner, sometimes violently. And the party watched you because it could, and because that form of control required visibility. And the horror of it was really, it was the force behind it. and the fact that you just had no choice. Now, Orwell's contemporary, Aldous Huxley, had a different idea. In his book, Brave New World, the citizens, they weren't really controlled through fear, you know, and the threat of violence exactly. They were controlled through comfort and, well, sedation and pleasure and distraction. Sound familiar? So, it's fair to say that they were under the control of the soft management of desire. Nobody needed to force anyone into anything because everything was everyone was more or less fine with how things were. I mean, they signed up willingly. So Huxley thought that this was the more insidious and, I guess, sophisticated version. And I think history has been proving him right for about the last 40 years or so, because the surveillance state that we actually got doesn't really look like 1984, at least not quite yet, anyway. Time will tell. But presently, we don't have armed helicopters, or I guess now it would be drones, you know, approaching everyone's windows and spying on us. Because the mechanism we have now, it's, I would say, considerably more elegant, definitely more subtle than that. Our version mostly comes with, in the form of a device that we enthusiastically purchased and that we carry on our person almost everywhere all the time. So the important element to all this is that the modern surveillance apparatus, it runs on convenience. So things like, I guess, like the comfort of a GPS or, you know, a streaming service that knows what you want to watch before you do. And the data collection and the privacy erosion, you know, that's real, but it arrives like it's wrapped in something that makes your life marginally easier. And so the cost doesn't quite register until you start paying a little more attention and you start adding things up. And the thing is, you know, most people don't want to add things up because that's uncomfortable. And the alternative, you know, just using the thing is right there and it works. And it's definitely a very powerful sedative, which is, you know, I think that's a much different form of control than what Orwell had envisioned. Now, you know, I guess he just didn't take into account how much people would actually enjoy the cage if the cage came with good speakers or whatever. So, all right, let's talk about what the actual infrastructure of this looks like, because I think most people, they do have a vague sense of, they have a vague sense that they're being watched more than they used to be without quite knowing the specifics. And the specifics, I think they are worth knowing. So, Flock Safety, the company that makes those oval cameras I mentioned earlier, they have something like 5 I think 5 million license plates being scanned every single day across their network. And their cameras are, they're logging plate numbers and vehicle descriptions, the time, the location. And it's building a database of movement patterns that then law enforcement can access retroactively. So if something happens in your neighborhood, investigators can go back and reconstruct who drove through and when, going back months. Now, I understand that this could be legitimately useful in solving crimes, right? I want to be fair about that. However, it also means that anyone driving anywhere near a Flock camera is being logged, whether they've done anything or not. Which, of course, is most people most of the time, you know, just going about their day. Well, and then there's the Ring camera situation, which has its own interesting dimension. So Amber's Ring network has partnered with thousands of police departments across the country, which allows law enforcement to request footage from homeowners' doorbell cameras. And a lot of homeowners just, you know, hand it over. No questions asked, right? Which I guess makes some sense from an individual perspective. I mean, you want to be helpful and you want to feel safe, but the aggregate effect here is a privately owned, community-operated surveillance network that's covering residential streets pretty much across the country. And nothing says neighborhood watch like everyone filming each other from their front porches and uploading it to a server somewhere in Northern Virginia. And I think what is suspiciously interesting about both of these systems is they didn't require any government mandate. Nobody passed a law requiring citizens to install surveillance cameras in their houses. People just bought them voluntarily because they wanted to see who was at the door, and, you know, or because the package theft was getting out of control. Or who knows, maybe their insurance company offered a discount or something. Not completely illegitimate reasons, of course. So the surveillance expanded through the individual, rational decisions that collectively produced something that none of those individuals necessarily intended or fully considered, which is usually the case. And that's, you know, I think that's how a lot of things happen. Nobody designs the outcome. Everyone just makes the locally sensible choice, right? And then one day what happens is you look up and the infrastructure is just there, covering everything. And it's been there long enough where it feels normal. And that's the part that sticks with me about all this. You know, all of this is pushed on us in the name of safety. And it's been snowballing for the last 25 years or so, and it's about to get a whole lot worse thanks to AI. All right, so if the camera's outside, you know, I guess So the outside cameras, that's one thing, right? But the device that's in your pocket or in the palm of your hand, that's something else entirely. Because the phone, it's not just tracking your location. It's building a behavioral model of you. So what you look at, how long you look at it, what you search for at 2:30 a.m. when you can't sleep, what you almost bought and then didn't, what topics make you stop scrolling. And all of that is being collected and analyzed, and it's being sold to people that you'll never meet, who are using it to predict what you'll do next before you even decided to do it. I mean, there are companies right now whose their business model is buying and selling this data brokers. And most people have never heard of them, which is more or less how they prefer it, not surprisingly. So your information gets packaged and sold and then resold and aggregated with other people's information. And eventually it ends up informing decisions about, you know, like what ads you see and what prices that you're offered, sometimes what insurance rates you get and things of the sort. So you're really no longer a person with a phone. You are a behavioral pattern with a purchase history and an emotional profile. And the thing that I find strange about this is how much of it we just actively contribute to without even giving it a thought. That's how deep we are into this now. And then we generate this information about ourselves pretty much constantly. And then we hand it over to systems that we don't really understand. And in exchange, we do get a service that's usually pretty good, actually, in various ways. And that's the transaction. And it's not nothing, because in spite of all of this, the navigation, you know, it is pretty helpful, right? It's just that the cost is on a level of behavioral transparency that would have seemed extraordinary like 20 or 25 years ago. And now it just feels like just the terms of participation. And I think the part that gets underreported is the predictive piece. Because, you know, it's one thing to track what you did, but it's another to use that data to model what you're likely to do next. You know, who you're likely to vote for, what you're susceptible to believing, how you respond under stress, and so forth. That's a whole different category of knowing somebody. I think that's, you know, that's the kind of knowledge that gets used for things other than selling you running shoes or whatever. All right, so there's one more layer to this that I want to mention before we get to the extra juicy stuff. Because up to this point, you could make a reasonable argument that most of this is happening to you. You know, infrastructure and systems you didn't build and cameras you didn't install. I mean, you didn't have anything to do with that, really. It's pretty much passive. You're just moving through a world that's been gradually, it's been gradually instrumented around you, I guess. So this next layer is social media, which is something else entirely, because the thing is nobody installed social media on the street corner without asking. People signed up voluntarily and then started documenting their lives in a level of detail and transparency that honestly it would have made a Soviet era surveillance agency emotional with gratitude. There was a time when we used to keep private journals. I mean, I kept journals for over 20 years, but now we live in an age where people post nervous breakdowns online with sponsored links underneath them. So, yet we have an audience now. And I understand why people do it. It's just that at some point, I think the line between living your life and producing content about your life, that line starts to get blurry. And I think once that happens, you start to lose track of which one is real, the real activity, and which one is the documentation of it, which is, I think, that's exactly what the platforms were designed to achieve. All right, this is where things start to get interesting. And by this, I mean the kind of interesting that makes you want to go live in a cabin somewhere and just figure out how to live off the land. I'm starting to wonder if the Amish and the Mennonites are the only organized, some of the only organized communities in the US that are going to survive outside of this rising technocracy. So you've probably heard about the digital ID systems that are starting to roll out across various countries. So this is a system where your identity basically it gets consolidated into a single digital credential. So you have ultimately you have one thing instead of a wallet full of things, full of cards. And yes, that does probably sound efficient and streamlined and sensible. But, the issue with this is that a single digital credential also means a single point of control. And that is a single point through which access can be granted or revoked automatically. And it's based on criteria that you probably will never see. And, systems as a general rule, they don't really do appeals. And then there's the issue of cash, because cash is the last truly, I guess, anonymous transaction that most people still have access to. You hand someone some paper, they give you something back, and there's no record of that exchange existing anywhere for the most part. And you probably have noticed that cash is dying, right? It's dying slowly, and being replaced through, the accumulation of, Well, it's the convenience of tap payments and digital wallets and the like, and buying everything online. But you know, it is, it's cash is slowly but surely, I think it's being phased out, unfortunately. And I think the problem here is that if we end up with a fully cashless society, well, then we also end up with a fully traceable one. So every transaction, digital transaction we do is logged and stored and available to whoever has access to the logs, which turns out to be increasingly handled by AI, of course, and a very small group of human beings that you've never met and, of course, never will. And then we have the central bank currencies, also known as CBDCs, which, you know, these things take things even further. So what this is, it's basically programmable money. It's currency that could theoretically be restricted based on how it's spent or where it's spent or by whom. So this could be depend on your status, you know, your income, your age, your race, your location, your background, and so forth. And this is not a fringe theory. This is a feature that the central banks have openly discussed and, you know, are considering as a design possibility. Just something to ponder over. And then I guess we should talk about vehicles for a minute, because the thing with modern cars, with all the computer chips now, they're basically like smartphones on wheels at this point. And they do quite a lot of data collection. But, you know, even more than this, some manufacturers are already, they've already been caught selling some of this behavior data to insurance companies without any clear disclosure. Shocking, right? But unfortunately, that is just the beginning. Because now we have these systems that are allowing remote disabling of a vehicle. Yeah. And, you know, this whole trajectory toward cars that can be controlled or shut down externally, I realize that that might sound like science fiction, but that's already showing up in the current technology. And I'm pretty sure that in the next couple of years, we're going to see this everywhere with new vehicles. And, you know, when you think about this, it really brings into question the concept of ownership. Because if your vehicle can be controlled remotely and certain features can be disabled because you can't afford the subscriptions or something, do you really own that vehicle at that point? And of course, all of this has to live somewhere physical, unfortunately. And where it's living is inside of these enormous concrete buildings that are consuming more electricity than small countries, and drinking up millions of gallons of water every day for cooling. And they're spreading everywhere. data centers. So the largest concentration of data centers on the planet currently exists outside of Washington, D.C., consuming vast resources, and they're operating continuously. And all of this is being done in the name of safety and convenience. When, I mean, let's be honest here, we know it's really about control, right? So, if the infrastructure that we just talked about is the body of this thing, then I think you could say that AI is like the nervous system. And I want to be careful here because I'm not really all that interested in the science fiction. I mean, I am, but I want to focus right now on what's already being deployed and what's already happening. Because, really, that's alarming enough without having to further embellish it. I mean, we've already got facial recognition running in airports and stadiums and casinos, and that's showing up like more and more public spaces all the time. I mean, this is happening on like every other street corner in some places. And the accuracy rates, which that used to be a legitimate counter argument to all that, that's gotten good enough now where that's no longer a reliable defense. The system sees you, it matches you to a database, it logs the encounter. Now, whether you consented to being in that database, that's a whole separate question and a whole other issue. All right, and then there's what's called predictive policing. So this is the idea that you can take historical crime data, right, and run it through an algorithm, and it more or less predicts where crime is likely to occur. And who's likely to commit the crimes. And that sounds pretty useful, I guess, right? It sounds like it would be a good thing. And it probably is in some instances. But then, upon further inspection, you start to realize that historical crime data contains historical bias. And if you feed biased data into an algorithm, that doesn't neutralize that bias. All that does is automate it. And it like gives it an air of objectivity that it hasn't really earned. And personally, I find that part especially upsetting because at least, if when a human being makes a biased judgment, there's a human being to argue with about it. But now you are increasingly having to argue with an algorithm, right? And that's an argument, and that's an argument that you're not going to win. So, workspace surveillance. This has become a standard thing in a lot of industries now, which means that you're being conspicuously monitored with productivity software that's tracking your keystrokes and your screenshots. It's tracking your mouse movement. And some of these systems will flag employees for insufficient activity. So, you've probably heard about the Amazon warehouse some of the Amazon warehouse workers that can't take a proper bathroom break because it'll affect their performance metrics. Yeah. I find all of this stuff to be straight up dystopian. I mean, we are there. Just the feeling of being watched and scrutinized all day long, it gives me the creeps, frankly. I get anxiety just thinking about it. And then, of course, there's the hiring side of this, which that's a whole other issue, because now, as some of you have probably experienced personally, AI filters can, they're screening resumes before any human ever even sees them. So your resume basically gets analyzed and discarded by an algorithm. And you might get lucky and actually get an interview, which then turns out to be with an AI as well. That sounds enjoyable. So then there's the algorithmic risk scoring that's going on, which that's influencing things like credit card decisions, parole recommendations, insurance rates, etc. So what's happening is that you are increasingly being interpreted by systems that they're just reducing you to a set of variables to generate probability. So you're no longer a person, basically, that's being evaluated. You're just like a pattern that's being predicted now. And the pattern, it doesn't know your name and it doesn't care about the context. It just outputs a number purely for the sake of, efficiency, I guess. So there is something that I think gets lost in the conversation about surveillance. All the technical infrastructure, like the cameras and the data centers and so forth, now that's all real, and of course it matters, but there is something underneath it that I find disturbing, or more disturbing than any specific system. And it's what permanent observation does to a person from the inside. All right, so there's this idea that Michel Foucault wrote about, where he took this 18th century prison design called the Panopticon, which was like a circular building where the inmates could, they couldn't really tell if they were being watched at any given moment because of the design. And Foucault used this as a framework for understanding how modern power actually operates. So his argument being that you don't need to watch everyone all the time. You just need people to believe that they might be being watched. And so what happens is then they start basically doing the job themselves. And I think this is already happening outside of prisons currently, thanks to social media. Because we are curating ourselves now online, right? I mean, and we've been doing this for years at this point. And people are editing themselves before posting something. And, you know, we've done this so much now that it doesn't even feel like a performance anymore. So what this means is that you have essentially hired yourself. You've hired yourself as your own surveillance officer. And the watchtower doesn't need to be occupied anymore. And this, here's the thing, this isn't just happening online, because the surveillance has gone social now. Everybody has a camera in their pocket and an instinct to use it, right? I mean, we do this automatically. And what that's done to how people behave in person, you know, this is something that I find slightly alarming. So recently I saw someone talking about, they're making the observation that people don't really dance anymore. Because, you know, unless it's some horrific thing you see on TikTok. But people aren't, they don't really dance anymore because dancing in public, well, that used to be a thing that it happened, and then it was over and gone. And, you know, if you danced badly, maybe you were temporarily embarrassed by it, right? For like a couple of days. No big deal. And nobody took any digital videos or photos and then posted them online for the world to ridicule. But now, that is our reality. Everything you do in public now is potentially seen by half the planet, and it's potentially permanent. So the risk calculation has immensely changed, right? And I think that that risk calculation is affecting more than just dancing. It's affecting how willing people are to be vulnerable and to do like uncertain and slightly embarrassing things that actual human connection usually requires. You know, you can't really form a relationship without taking some social risks. And social risk taking, well, I mean, it gets a heck of a lot harder when the possibility of being recorded and judged is just, that's the reality now, right? You know, it's almost unavoidable these days. So that's the thing about surveillance. It's not just about the state or the corporation watching you and building a behavioral profile. It's also the person across from you at the social function with their phone out. And it's the awareness that at any moment, whatever you're doing could become content. So what that's producing is a population that's getting better at performing and worse at actually being present to each other. And present to themselves, for that matter. Which I think, that's a pretty different kind of loss than what Foucault was writing about. And I find this realization to be, you know, it's more concerning than the camera. Because cameras, well, you can at least sometimes see and theoretically avoid. But the internal version, that's invisible. And most people, they don't notice this moving until it's already been there for a while and rearranging the furniture, so to speak. Okay. So I'm not going to tell you to throw your phone in the lake after all of that. Partly because it probably wouldn't help much at this point anyway. And besides, that's not very good for the lake either. And I'm not going to profess to have the solutions here. I'm well aware that some of what I've described in this monologue is essentially incapable or inescapable for anyone that's living inside this modern reality that we're in. And you can't completely opt out of something like a flock camera by not driving a car. And you're not going to be able to thoroughly opt out of facial recognition by hiding your face. You know, the infrastructure, it exists whether you engage with it or not. But I do think that there's a difference between conscientious or, I guess, like passive participation and enthusiastic participation in all this. And that difference, it might be the only lever that most people actually have. Unless, of course, you can just head to the wilderness and figure out how to live without any of this. More power to you if you have that option. But I mean, realistically, let's face it. You know, that's not going to happen for 99 point whatever percent of people. So I think some of what we can do is simple, practical, small things like obviously taking breaks, at least as best we can from technology. And, you know, just also keeping in mind that there is still a world out there that it doesn't involve technology. I mean, these devices are not 100% mandatory in our lives. Not yet, anyway. So maybe just try to turn them off sometimes and leave them at home. At least the ones that you have control over. Leave them at home for a few hours. And, you know, if you're going to buy something, if you can, try to use cash more often while you can. And maybe, like, I think try to be a little bit more deliberate in what you actually document and what you know, just let be a moment that just belongs to you. Or, you know, the few people you're with. I would just try to just let it be a practice of learning how to enjoy something in the moment and to let it go when that moment's over. And yeah, some of this is more psychological because I think, you know, the internal surveillance with the self-editing and the performance of normality and the risk calculation that's making people afraid to dance badly in public, I think that one you can actually have some jurisdiction over. Not completely, but some, definitely some. Which means occasionally doing something awkward, you know, unpolished, regardless. And just being visually imperfect in a space where someone might be recording. I think it's just a matter of being willing to partake in like a small act where you're trying to remain being a person rather than a performance. It's pretty clear that the establishment wants your attention and your data. It wants your behavioral compliance and your self-surveillance. But, you know, if you're giving it all of these things at the same time, I think that is quite corrosive. And I think we do possess some agency in how we respond to this stuff. Though I do think it does involve living in ways that require some degree of inconvenience and discomfort. I think we have to be willing to allow these things back into our lives. All right. That's all I've got today. Thanks for listening.